Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy, and we will be joined in a little bit by TCU coach Jim Schlossnagel. Before we get to that, all of that, though, I want to let you know that the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we are here. We are recording. It is Monday, October 26th, and I say this explicitly because you guys might know how the World Series ends when you're listening to this. Joe and I and our guest Jim Schlossnagel, we did not when we were recording this. So we talk a little bit about the World Series with in the interview with Coach Schlossnagel, because he was able to be at Game 1, the World Series being held in Arlington, of course, TCU not too far away. He went with his kids. We talk a little bit about that experience, but the World Series overall has been a lot of really great baseball, exciting games, and you know, we'll see if it ends tonight or not. But Joe, it's truly been a fall classic.
Indeed, can't ask for a whole lot more. It was, you know, arguably the two best teams in baseball and two well-run organizations. It's, you know, the Rays with kind of their brains and doing it the way they do it, and the Dodgers with all the talent they have and they've been on the cusp for so long. So you, as a baseball fan, you really can't ask for too much more. Apparently some people can ask for more though, because we have also reached, I'm sure you've seen this on Twitter as well, we have reached the point of the World Series though where the old school ball writers are all kind of looking for day World Series games and talking about how great that would be. And I have a different gripe with the World Series games, is that now that I live on the East Coast, I now truly understand why people complain about how late things start over here. I totally get that now. I underestimated the degree to which that was a real problem logistically when you live on the East Coast. But I don't necessarily understand why there seems to be so much interest in having World Series games start at 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. or what have you. I mean, I guess it's a kind of a do it for the children kind of thing, but beyond that, I'm not really sure why that seems to pick up steam every October as an idea.
Yeah. Count me completely out on that. There was also a lot of griping earlier this summer when MLB released a schedule that was just about like almost entirely night games. And people are like, well, why can't we mix in some day games here in this year? You know, everyone's at home. Like, you don't really have to give people a chance to get home to watch the game. Like, why can't we just have some day games? And like, I mean, I get it. Like, when I'm at home, like, I generally have sports on in the background, but like, I don't want, you know, that drama. I don't need that. Like, around the time I'm like trying to cook dinner, like cooking dinner while the World Series is going into the seventh inning or whatever. Like, I don't know. I don't get it. And the one year in Omaha recently where they had a championship game during the day, of course, was 2016 when Coastal won, because there was that extra day and that's how it just fit best into the schedule. Of course, 2 years later when Oregon State won on a Thursday again, they had to take an extra day because of weather. That was a night game. So I don't know if they learned their lessons from 2016 or what, but that game just always felt kind of weird with Coastal winning. It was the middle of the day. There weren't really fans in the stands to a large degree, certainly not to the degree that you'd expect for a championship game. I didn't need to see that again necessarily, but I in general don't really like the day game, that the whole flow of the day, and this is totally just a selfish like perspective from how my day flows. I don't like how the day flows if it's a day game. I like the familiar flow of a night game, but yeah, I definitely something has to be done. I don't know if it's an earlier start time or pace of play or both or whatever, but the games do end awful late. Really, no matter where you are, I guess out west, you know, if you're on the West Coast, not so late, but you know, even in the Central Time Zone, these games are ending pretty late, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, my childhood living in the Central Time Zone was littered, even at an age when it was okay for me to be staying up, you know, as late as these games go, was littered with examples of me falling asleep on the couch trying to finish watching some extra inning game or playoff baseball, basketball, whatever game that I just couldn't make it for. So the West Coast is kind of the outlier there, and I find that's a very polarizing discussion when you talk to people about what is it like being a sports fan on the West Coast, because I think half the people will tell you it's fabulous because you don't have to worry about the super late starts and, you know, being up really, really late just to get to the end of a game. And I think some people, especially NFL fans, like the fact that you kind of just wake up, roll out of bed and have NFL games on Sunday or college football games on Saturday, as it were. On the other hand, I've never lived out there. I've only been out there for little pockets of time, but I think I'd find it more weird than anything else that, you know, you finish work at, let's say you have a traditional job and you get off at 4 or 5 in the afternoon and the games on the East Coast are already starting. I think that would be weird. And I also don't care for the fact that I like to, as much as I'm complaining about having the super late starts, I do like having games that end after 10 p.m. Like I like to be able to go to bed and kind of doze off with a game on, or just finish a game and go straight to bed or what have you. And the West Coast, you never really get that. I remember being in Arizona for opening weekend last year. And, you know, the NBA is going on, because remember at the time, things weren't shut down yet. They were just about to in about a month. But I remember, you know, NBA season is right in the thick of it, and the NHL season is right in the thick of it. And, you know, I'm back at the hotel at the end of the night and working on writing some stuff. And like you, you know, you put sports on in the background and everything is over. And it's just kind of a weird way to live, that all the sports is over by 10 o'clock at night or so. And I think that was as weird as anything else. So I'm not sure where I fall on that, but I find that is a pretty polarizing topic on whether the West Coast is the best or the worst in terms of following sports.
Yeah, it's tricky, no doubt. But one thing that we can agree on is that we're very happy that the World Series is, you know, here, and they're going to complete it, and baseball's done a good job with that. And so hopefully we can get a similar story for college baseball in the College World Series next spring, because, you know, seeing this all play out has, you know, kind of heightened the, like, oh yeah, there was no college baseball champion this year. That's kind of terrible. You know, that all kind of has come back during these playoffs, at least for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think it's been heightened by paying more attention to fall baseball. Like I've been going to fall practices and scrimmages and stuff for, I guess, about a month now. But the last couple of weeks, it has heightened a little bit, because I've also spent a lot more time on the phone with coaches talking about fall practice. So it's kind of gotten me back in that rhythm, which is good, but it is also a reminder that, man, it has been a really long time since we've had college games of consequence.
Absolutely. Well, let's get to one of those coaches who actually has completed their fall practice now, and that's TCU and Jim Schlossnagel. They finished up, I guess, just this past weekend, they completed their fall World Series there at TCU. Horned Frogs, a very interesting team as we look at 2021. They bring back the almost the entire team from 2020, add another top 15 recruiting class into it, and, you know, that looks like a Big 12 contender right there with you know, with the likes of Texas Tech and Oklahoma State at the top of the conference. So very interesting team. Going to get into it in a minute here with Jim Schlossnagel. Before we do so, though, let's get a word from our sponsors, Keeps. As guys, so much of our identity is wrapped up in our hair, from how it feels after getting a fresh cut to the way it's perfectly styled before going out. That's why when we get into our 20s and 30s, we start noticing the first signs of hair loss, it definitely feels like panic time. Because let's face it, no guy ever is ready to go bald. Thankfully, now there's Keeps, the simple and easy way to keep your hair. two out of three guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness by the time they're 35. The best way to prevent hair loss is to do something about it while you still have hair left. With Keeps, you can get treated from home. You used to have to go to the doctor's office for your hair prescription. Now, thanks to Keeps, you can visit a doctor online and get hair loss medication delivered right to your home. They make it easy and deliver your medication every 3 months so you can say goodbye to pharmacy checkout lines and awkward doctor visits. Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. You may have tried them before, but probably never for this price. Prevention is key. Keeps treatments typically take between 4 and 6 months to see results, so it's important to act fast. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll have. If you're ready to take action and prevent hair loss, go to keeps.com/baseballamerica to receive your first month of treatment for free. That's KEEPS.com/baseballamerica. All right, so with that, let's get to TCU coach Jim Schlossnagle. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we're excited to be joined by TCU coach Jim Schlossnagle. Coach, always a good time to talk with you and to talk about the Frogs. But before we get into the Frogs, I know you were able to attend game one of the World Series. It's been a really thrilling World Series so far. I just wondered, you know, what was the experience like with that, and what have you thought about the World Series that we've seen to this point?
Yeah, Teddy. Joe, thanks for having me on. It's always exciting. I think I've been to four of the last five World Series. And when you attend a World Series in Wrigley Field and you attend a World Series in Fenway Park with a full stadium, you know, it certainly is going to be different when you're trying to do it in a COVID era. But the new stadium is amazing. I think the Rangers and Major League Baseball has, you know, they've really done a good job of putting it on. It's obviously pretty easy to get in and out of, and we are supposed to open our season actually in that ballpark. So I got a tour of it when it was about 40% complete, and then game one was the first time I had been in it since it had been completed. So it was great to see that, and the series has been awesome. You know, I mean, I have my own rooting interest, but I'm certainly hoping for seven games only because I just want to see as much baseball as we can get. And very, 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 like I'm sure you guys are and the entire baseball community, just so grateful for everybody involved with Major League Baseball for being able to put together some level of season so that we all get to enjoy the sport.
The ending of game four is going to be the ending that we see in highlight reels for the rest of time. Have you in your coaching career been a part of a game that ended in a similarly crazy way to what we saw in game four of the World Series?
You know, I don't, I mean, the closest thing to it that I can remember would be how we won the Super Regional against Texas A&M here in 2015 when we played 16 innings and we had an inning where we had the bases loaded in the bottom of the 14th or 15th, and Evan Skoug hit a ball off the pitcher's chest and directed it, went with one out, and it went directly to the first baseman who threw the ball home. I didn't think there was any way we were going to win the game after that happened. And then in the bottom of the 16th inning, Garrett Crane's at second base and Skoug hits a ball down the third baseline that the third baseman catches, but then drops it. And when he goes to pick it up, Crane runs right straight through a stop sign at third base, and he's going to be out. But, you know, the third baseman bounced the throw, and it got by the catcher, and that was the winning run of a 16-inning Game 3 Super Regional. So that's about as close to, as I think I've ever seen to a game like that.
Those were some amazing Super Regionals.
Yeah.
And every meeting, it seems like, that you guys have with the Aggies at this point, really.
Yeah, we've played some Super Regionals like that. We played them a 15-inning game in the Minute Maid Classic, played them in the College World Series. So, you know, they have a good program down there and a great program, I should say. And Coach Childress and those guys do an awesome job. So it always just like the other hotbed areas of the country, you know, whether it be Texas or Southern California or the Carolinas or Florida, you know, you're in order to get to Omaha, normally you're going to have to beat one of those really good teams in your region to get out. And so in our specific state, the games have just been crazy.
You've now finished up fall ball back there at TCU. Just what was it like to get the team back out on the field and to play together again after, you know, the extended off season and the abrupt nature of the way 2020 ended?
It was awesome. I mean, it was super emotional for me, at least, because I'm not a golfer. I really enjoy my job. I don't consider it an occupation. It's a lifestyle to me. And what was really miserable about the back half of, you know, from March 11th or 12th on throughout the summer was just not having the players around. And I think everybody, if they didn't already realize, we all like to use the word relationships and talk about those things. But I tell you what, when the most important people in this entire college athletic equation are the student athletes. And when they're not around, I mean, it's like you feel useless because your job is, you know, it's just so fun. They keep you young. Really, it's fun to just banter back and forth with guys, and sure, they frustrate you sometimes, but just the opportunity to be around them every day is what you really miss, and let alone the competition itself. So I was a guy, I'm not afraid to admit that I had gotten to the point in my career where I've always loved practice, but I didn't really enjoy the games because of, I guess, the pressure and you know, what every single game has so much riding on it. I just had gotten to the point in my career that, which is bad, that I really didn't enjoy the games. I just wanted the games to be over with. I wanted to win them, but I just didn't enjoy them themselves. And once you have that taken away, boy, I tell you what, I'll never say that again. I'll never feel that again. I've enjoyed every single ounce of this fall. We just finished yesterday, 6 weeks of fall practice, and we didn't have any interruptions. We had some guys out here and there, but for the most part, we had a great inter-squad World Series, super competitive, and just like you said, just to be able to be on a baseball field again, I mean, that's not something I will ever allow myself nor our players or staff to ever take for granted again.
The team was off to a nice start in 2020, some really impressive series wins, Kentucky and Minnesota, Cal. Got to SoCal, played well, a couple one-run losses there, nothing to be ashamed of there. What did you learn about your team through that first month before things got canceled?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of really good teams here, and but in terms of just a fun group of guys to be around with, very cohesive, had great synergy, just fun to be in the dugout with, like a lot of true ball players, not the sexiest in terms of high-end, you know, draft talent necessarily, or the names that you would read, you know, in Baseball America per se, but just a lot of just competitive ball players that bought into a system. And yeah, just what you said, to give you an example how much I loved our team, we lost three of our last four games. You know, we were 11-1 at one point, or 10-1, and then lost three of our last four, all of them by, well, the UTA game was by two runs, I think, but the Vandy by a run and USC by a run, and we beat UCLA. We lost three of our last four, but I felt really good about our team. And so I felt like it was the best defensive club we've had, super competitive, balanced order through the lineup. And I thought our pitching was really had a chance to be special. And, you know, to have that cut short really stunk, but within a week, you know, or so, we got word that everybody was going to be able to have an extra year of eligibility and come back if they wanted to. And fortunately for us, they all did. So we have that same group back with some super talented young players. And I don't know what kind of season we're going to have, but I can tell you, to be around these guys every single day is one of the greatest joys of my coaching career.
Yeah, I mean, you have that team back. You added another solid recruiting class. What stood out to you in the fall, just seeing those guys a year older now? Did you see the kind of development over the summer that you normally would, or was that a lot of stuff that you guys had to work on? You know, what did you see from this group this fall?
Well, I saw two things. And certainly you saw just the maturity and the leadership of the older group that just continued. And my challenge to them going into the fall was, you know, we just can't assume, you can't add 15 or so or however many new players we have to the mix and expect to have the exact same team cohesion, synergy, chemistry, you know, whatever you want to call it. You have to start at ground zero and develop those relationships during a COVID time where you're not supposed to hang out together, whether it be in the locker room or away from the field. So the guys, they've done an awesome job of that. Guys like Zach Humphries, Halen Green, Charles King. There's eight of them there, so they all do a great job. Five of the eight are in their sixth year of college, which I think is an absolutely beautiful thing. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, on a team that returns everybody that played for it last year, we have some really talented young players that have absolutely forced their way into the conversation of being able to play, if it's not every day, pretty close to it. And when you have a group of older guys like we have who have been around, you know, they're 24, you know, some of them 23, 24, one will be 25 during the season, and they're coming up to me after practice and saying, wow, so these young guys, man, I mean, they're opening some eyes. So I'm really excited about that. And I'm just hoping that we can get to play as close to 56 or more games as we'll be allowed to play in the spring, because we need to be able to get these, you know, all these guys in the game. And our challenge, you know, barring contact tracing, COVID, or other type injuries, our challenge is just going to be, you know, keeping their egos in check and knowing that you can be a really good player in this program and not get a whole lot of opportunity. And when you do, you got to be ready for it. So super excited about both the older guys and the young players.
You mentioned all that experience, and, you know, I haven't done the background research on this, but I have a hard time imagining there's a major conference team that has more sixth year guys than you guys have. So I'm curious how you see that playing out in the spring, and in what ways does that really become a difference maker for you guys? Because I think it's something that we say all the time, you know, and we know it to be true that, you know, being older is better, and with experience comes these positive things. But from a coach's perspective, walk us through a little bit how that stuff ends up mattering once you get to, you know, I don't know, mid-April and you're in the grind of a Big 12 season.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, you don't want to be the team that says, yeah, we got all of our guys back, but we were 4-11 that last year. That's no good, right? So, you know, just having guys back doesn't make you good. I mean, whether they're older or not, you want good players back. And so, I mean, almost every single one of those eight seniors, and then you throw in guys like Johnny Ray, Russell Smith, they're all pro prospects. And I think in a normal year, in a normal draft with normal free agent signings, every single one of them would have had a chance to play. And most of them did. They just, you know, that they weren't going to give up getting their degree or even their master's degree for a $20,000 free agent signing or, you know, 200 grand in the fifth round. So, I think they all wanted to know that, you know, we had a chance to do something special last year, and they wanted to be a part of that again. So that's the first thing, is I don't want people to think, you know, just because you have older players back, doesn't, you know, that they need to be talented, because we're trying to win the games. But the other side of that is, you know, older players, they've been around the block. So nothing phases them. If they have a bad day, it's just on to the next day. They're able to get to the middle. You know, they never get too high. I know it sounds coachy, never get too low. But they also have a great hunger, because, you know, we still have four players, I believe, that were on our last World Series team. So they're able to relay those messages. But we a lot of those older players are guys that were signed with the intent of getting us back to Omaha. They know the standard here. They know what has been accomplished, and they know what hasn't been accomplished, which is playing in a championship series in Omaha and winning a national title. So they're very hungry. They want to be that first team that finishes it out, or at least the next team that gets back to Omaha. And so we're going to lean on that. But to be honest with you, they're going to have to play well to play. There are some young guys, again, I keep going back to that. And some of them, a couple of these guys that are really good young players for us, they weren't the most high-profile recruits. But I think whether it be this spring or in years to come, they're going to be names that you guys are going to be talking about a lot. So we are fired up for the older players, and their experience will carry us a long way, but they're going to have to play well.
You mentioned the pitching there, and I actually wanted to zero in on that for just a second, because it is an interesting group. You've got guys back. You mentioned some names with Charles King and Russell Smith and Johnny Ray, a guy like Halen Green. And at the same time, you know, you've got some guys, and I just single these guys out because they're probably names that a lot of our listeners might recognize, guys like Riley Cornelio and Jacob Metter, who are going to, you know, I imagine at this point you kind of are looking to put them in a little bigger role given their talent. So I'm curious how you and Kirk are kind of working through that and what kind of competition you've had there and how you start to assess what kind of roles we're going to be talking about for this kind of abundance of talented arms you have.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're working through that. We've just challenged all those guys, all the ones you've named. There's one that you've missed that probably is the most talented of them all, that was just literally going to be an emerging star in college baseball last spring. I'll tell you about him in a minute. You know, we've just challenged them, you know, just like we do every year. You got to become the very best version of yourself, control what you can control. And then a lot of this is going to be dictated by what does the college baseball season look like, not just in the number of games played, but also how it's structured. So, for example, you're probably starting to hear a lot about conferences talking about four-game weekends. So playing four games in a weekend is certainly going to either expose how deep your pitching staff is or the lack of depth in it. And so for us, I'm hoping we get to play five games a week, because at least right now, I'm not saying we're going to be perfect, we're even going to be the best, but I like the number of pitchers that we have and how talented they are. And I just want to have enough innings for them to continue to, you know, shine and help us win games, and for especially the younger players to help them develop. So certainly Johnny Ray, Russell Smith, those two guys were doing a great job for us last year. But we have a left-handed pitcher by the name of Austin Krobe, who was just coming into his own in our UCLA game there that last weekend. He pitched out of the bullpen, and we all know what kind of offensive team UCLA had last year. The high picks, the you know, Coach Savage does an awesome job, and he punched out eight, I think, in four innings, and was really gaining confidence and was probably headed towards the rotation. And he has taken that and really run with it. And so, you know, he's a guy like right now who's he's going to be in our rotation for sure. Whose spot he takes, I'm not sure yet. But Austin Krobe is a name that you're really going to start to hear a lot about. We've had some super talented left-handed pitchers here. Matt Perk, Alex Young, Tyler Alexander, obviously Nick Lodolo, Brandon Finnegan. And this guy might be as good as all of them. And so we're really excited about him. But yeah, I mean, we're just going to have to get those guys innings, and whether it be piggyback games or let them go with it. You know, our job's to win the ball game. So we're going to do what we have to do that, but hopefully we'll get maximum number of innings, over the course of, you know, 56 games.
Yeah, you've mentioned the schedule, and, you know, we're about 4 months out from what is supposed to be opening day. Where are you in terms of that process? What guidance do you still need from the NCAA or from the conference office to go about, you know, shoring up the schedule, not just for TCU, but throughout college baseball?
Yeah, I think all these things are going to be dictated conference to conference. I think everybody is super hopeful of being able to play a full and normal schedule, and that's what we're planning to do. But for example, so many things are out of your control. So we've already seen the Mountain West go to 47 games. We don't have a Mountain West Conference school on our schedule, but we do have a West Coast Conference school on our schedule or a Southland Conference school on our schedule. And so what you don't want to do is plan on a normal schedule and then have one of those conferences maybe with, you know, less than the number of games, and all of a sudden they call and cancel the trip. So there may be some proactive things that happen on the front end where conferences, you know, just say, well, we're going to go to a 12 plus one or 13 plus one, 13 conference weekends plus one non-conference weekend, four game series, you know, Thursday to Sunday or Friday to Sunday, just to assure themselves of games. But I do think we'll know something within the next couple of weeks, in the first couple of weeks of November. And the people in the Big 12 office, our baseball liaison there, Jeff Jackson, has been awesome, super positive and proactive. And I know there's been a lot of communication from Power Five conferences to each, and as well as the other conferences like the American. So I'm pretty positive about us being able to play 50 to 56 games. What that looks like, if they're all conference, if they're regional, if they're Power Five only, I think is yet to be seen. But I'm not sure how much the NCAA baseball committee is going to, you know, have a say in that. I think it's going to be more conference to conference, just like we've seen in all the other sports.
So we'll wrap up here with the favorite question Teddy and I asked to all of our guests. We end on a little bit of a fun note here. So we're going to ask you, Jim Schlossnagel, to describe your favorite sandwich.
My favorite sandwich.
Yeah, it can be, you know, we've had a lot of different answers. Some people choose to kind of build their own sandwich, like describe that, which is great. Some people give us a specific sandwich at like a specific local place. So you can really go anywhere on the board here.
That's some pressure, man.
It is. It's the toughest question we ask, honestly.
I'm a big BLT guy. So
okay.
I guess it sounds pretty generic, but I guess
I'm a big believer in that too. So I'm here for that. I'm a big believer in that too. I'm here for this answer.
Yeah, I would say, you know, just some, you know, some quality on wheat with some fresh tomatoes, lettuce, some big league bacon from somewhere, you know, some great farm here in Texas, and kind of some light mayo, maybe a little salt and pepper. And, you know, I'll just kind of roll with that. If I had to do a 1B, I would have to go with some pulled pork barbecue sandwich with some pickles. That's right there with it. 1A, 1B.
That would certainly hit the spot. The thing with you say it's a boring answer with BLT, but here's the thing. I mean, the BLT would not have lasted as long as it has in the world if it wasn't a good sandwich, you know? So, I mean,
yeah, I agree with that. And I'm not a big fan of how people try to manipulate the BLT. Like, we got the avocado BLT or the turkey BLT or all these other things. I mean, I'm just pretty straightforward with the generic BLT with some fresh, fresh ingredients.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm with you there.
two great sandwich choices there. Can't go wrong with either one, I would say.
Outstanding.
Well, Coach, we're going to look forward to seeing the Frogs out there next year. We'll see where that is exactly, but I know I'm excited to see you know, that team. And when you describe those guys, everyone that you have back, all the new players coming in, it's hard not to be excited to see how 2021 will go for the Frogs. So we're going to be looking forward to following you guys next spring.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And, you know, in the coaches I talk to, I think just about 80% of the coaches I talk to are excited about their team. This is it's going to be a great era, a great year of college for college baseball when you have more good players coming back to school and you have more great players coming into school. So that's what I've reminded our team. I mean, our coaching staff, our players feel really good about our team, but I think everybody does. And so the level of play, I think the level of pitching in college baseball this year is going to be in an all-time high. So it's going to make for a great season. And we really appreciate what you guys do at Baseball America to promote our great sport. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. We're happy to have you here on the podcast, and we'll see you next spring.
Okay. Take care, guys. See ya.
Thank you to TCU coach Jim Schlossnagel for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, like we said, it's an interesting team. And, you know, listening to Coach Schlossnagel talk about it, a lot to like at various places, you know, just the age, the amount of arms they have that they can run out there. I don't know. It's going to be an interesting team to watch as we move into 2021.
No doubt about that. I wonder if it's one of the reasons I think it's interesting is that I wonder if it's going to be a tale of two seasons as far as TCU goes, because I really do like the group they have coming back. I saw them towards the end of the year when they were out in Southern California. And one of the things I liked is that the offense is the best way I've described it is it's a grown-up offense. Like nobody out there in that lineup, as Coach Schlossnagel kind of alluded to, nobody in that lineup is like a really big can't-miss prospect. There's a lot of really nice players, but they're pretty physical. They're mature. They have good approaches to the plate. So I like that experience back in lineup. I like that experience back on the mound. The guys that we talked about with Coach Schlossnagel. But what I have to wonder is that a lot of their more talented guys, and you know, I mentioned Cornelio and Metter, and you know, he mentioned Krobe, and you know the freshmen better than I do, the last couple of recruiting classes. But the thing about it is, though, is that their more talented players are probably those underclassmen. And so I wonder if it's a deal where, and this is where experience can really pay off. If you roll out there with a lineup that looks a lot like it did at the end of last year, and a rotation that looks, you know, kind of similar to what we saw last year with, you know, Charles King and Johnny Ray and Russell Smith. And by the time they kind of get going in Big 12 play, they've had a little more time with the younger guys. And I just wonder if it's a deal where by the time they get into the teeth of not just Big 12 play, but then get into the postseason, if the guys that are really driving the bus for TCU aren't the guys that were driving the bus for TCU in March and before they get into Big 12 play, because I think that's absolutely on the table for this team. And that's not, I don't think that's a dig at their veteran players. I just think that that's maybe one of the benefits they'll have is they do have the benefit of giving some of these younger guys a little bit of time because they have so much experience in front of them.
I know they were very excited to get Johnny Ray and Russell Smith back in the rotation, and they bring an awful lot to the table, just both in terms of experience and stuff. Those are two guys who threw 21 innings each last year, ERAs of about 2.5. They struck out more than 20 batters each. Like, those are two really good guys to have, and to have them both coming back this year is significant. And then you look at what a Krobe or a Cornelio, you know, or a freshman like Cam Brown, what they could add into it. And, you know, it has the chance to be like one of those really, really good pitching and defense TCU teams that they rode to Omaha, you know, so many times over the last decade. So from that standpoint, I'm very excited. From an offensive standpoint, I'm just kind of interested to see how it goes. You know, I didn't get a chance to see TCU last year with them, you know, going out to California instead of going to the Shriners College Classic like they so often do. You know, I hadn't gotten a chance to see them yet, and it's an interesting group offensively. You know, Porter Brown hadn't really like found his stride yet last year. They have a fair amount of depth though. And, you know, if it's going to be about some mixing and matching, I think, and just, you know, Jim Schlossnagel and his staff, you know, just trying to figure out what works best for this group, how you best line them up to get the most out of them offensively and defensively. And, you know, Bill Mosiello, their hitting coach, is one of the best offensive people in college baseball. You know, he's very much earned that reputation over the last two decades, you know, just in coaching, longer than that even. And, you know, so I have no doubt that they're going to have a solid offense. I just don't know quite what it's going to look like right now. But I think because they have so much pitching, they're going to be afforded some time to kind of find that right offensive mix, whatever that ends up being.
I think that's right. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I would draw is just in that one weekend in Southern California, I think you saw a little bit of maybe the benefit of the lineup they had and the limitation, where they have a game against USC where they lose 2-1 and USC throws Kyle Hurt, who was coming on strong in 2020. And it's actually a guy I was really interested to see what became of him as the season went on, because he's always been a talented arm that just hadn't quite put it together. But he goes out there against TCU and strikes out 9 in 6 innings and really controls them. And, you know, TCU's offense was just kind of flat that night. But then later in the weekend, they come out and they face Jack Leiter. And it was a game I was there for. And it wasn't like they really just completely bombarded Jack Leiter, but they worked a bunch of walks off him. They worked a bunch of deep counts. Jack Leiter never really seemed in control of that game. And I think that against a young pitcher like Jack Leiter, that's the kind of thing the TCU offense could do to a pitcher like that. If it's an inexperienced arm, if it's a pitcher that's not quite feeling their oats that day, that was the kind of day that you could have against TCU, because that was a lineup that wasn't going to beat themselves, wasn't going to give up at-bats, was really going to make you work for it. And if you're a big-time arm like Kyle Hurt was, that was on his game, you can beat that TCU lineup, because it remains to be seen what kind of game changers they had in the order. But on the other hand, they had so much depth and they knew who they were as a team that if you had a younger pitcher who maybe didn't have it quite all figured out or maybe just wasn't on their game that day, it was a lineup that could really hurt you, because they just kind of kept coming. Every time you get past one guy, you've got to deal with the next guy. And so I think there is a little bit of a ceiling there, or at least there was in 2020. But I also think that the floor was pretty high, just given the level of experience they already had, which will obviously be on another level in 2021.
I also was very interested to hear from Coach Schlossnagel about the scheduling aspect. We didn't really get into this too much in the interview, but you know, he's a vice president in the ABCA. He's involved in a lot of high-level discussions about things around the sport. And, you know, so his optimism about playing a full schedule is heartening. But I also think that, you know, there was an amount of, you know, okay, but here are backup plans in case this doesn't work out. And, you know, that's something that is going to be important, because, you know, there's a lot to be decided. You know, we're 4 months out from opening day, a little less than 4 months out. There's a lot to be decided still about the schedule. You know, when you look at the struggle that college football had putting a schedule together, you know, maybe if you're somebody in baseball, you're saying, well, okay, we're not football for a whole number of reasons, starting with the fact that because the NCAA controls the championship, they have a little more power over this thing. But then to watch basketball go through the struggle that they're having, as we record this, basketball season is supposed to start in a month. And just today on Monday, it was announced that ESPN, which was slated to host a whole bunch of early season non-conference tournaments at Disney World, and, you know, at their athletic, you know, village down there in Disney, that they were having to cancel that. And that affected, I don't even know how many teams, a ton of teams had their schedules thrown into disarray a month before the season starts. And, you know, I don't know. It's just premature to think that anybody really knows what the baseball season is going to look like, what the schedule is going to look like, just because there are so many factors that go into it. So, you know, backup plans are going to be important, and it's going to be interesting to see over the next month or so, especially in the next couple of weeks, like Schlossnagel was talking about, how various conferences go about allowing their teams to schedule things. Are they, you know, how many non-conference games, how many games overall are they going to allow teams to play? And so that's kind of one of the next things a lot of people in college baseball are looking to as they either wind down their fall, or now that their fall's wrapped up, they're now looking to some guidance on scheduling, because that kind of stuff, they need to have a much firmer idea than they have right now pretty quickly because, you know, it feels far away now, but next week it'll be November. And, you know, pretty quickly, especially when you throw the holidays into it, things start rolling downhill. And, you know, the start of January is, you know, typically, you know, when they're allowed to start holding preseason practices again. And, you know, that's coming very quickly. So some clarity on what the season looks like, hopefully will be coming sooner than later.
That is so true, by the way, about time just starting to roll downhill once you get to Thanksgiving in terms of getting the college season here. That is so true.
It's honestly scaring me just as I think about like preseason stuff that I have to do, that you have to do, that like we all have to do. And it's just like, oh boy, like it feels like we don't need to do it right now because it still says October. But like once it says November, like things get real.
Yeah, no doubt. It is crazy how that works. The off season is so long in a normal year, and this year obviously more so. But once you get to Thanksgiving, it's like the brakes just completely come off of the car, and we just start rumbling towards opening day. But anyway, yes, I am with you in being interested to see what comes of scheduling, and already we started to get a sense of that. The Mountain West has come out, and Coach Losnagel alluded to it. The Mountain West has come out and, you know, set a 47 game schedule with 36 of those coming in conference. And, you know, I tweeted about this earlier, like I poked around and found that at least on their site. Now let's see if this actually sticks and becomes their schedule, but Jackson State has put their schedule out and it's very conference heavy and it's, you know, 40 some odd games. And it's worth noting the SWAC typically plays a little lighter schedule as it is, but I think that's some evidence that I think this is smart, is I think, mission one for these schools and conferences should be take care of your conference stuff first and put an emphasis on what can we do to really play the most games possible. And I think that's going to be maximizing your conference games, as much as I enjoy good non-conference events and non-conference series. And I, you know, if I was a betting man, I'd say we still have some of those. But to your point, I think people were feeling pretty good about the way college basketball was going. Last couple of weeks, it felt like there's a lot of optimism about, hey, you know, we're going to have, it's going to be a couple weeks late, but we're, you know, we're going to have a mostly normal non-conference in terms of the big events. We're going to, what feels like kind of like a mostly normal non-conference schedule for the big programs in college basketball, where they're going to be involved in these multi-team events, as they call them, MTEs, and everybody will get these big games and we'll have the Champions Classic. And that might still be the case. Champions Classic, not part of the group in Orlando that's been necessarily been just canceled outright, but now all of a sudden we're in a very different place. And so things can change pretty quickly. And that's why I say that I think I would look for more conferences to be a little more insular and say, what can we do to maximize our conference games and minimize risk, of course. And part of that is maximizing conference games. I know you, Teddy, have had conversations with coaches about what the conference or what the schedules are going to look like. I've had some of those similar conversations. And what I will say is that at the very least, it is nice that I have not had a conversation in a long, long time with a coach who felt pessimistic about what the season would look like. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what it will look like, but I'm just hearing a lot less pessimism in general about, I'm not sure, you know, we might play 30 total games, and maybe some of the smaller conferences may, but among the coaches I've talked to, there's just not as nearly as much pessimism about what could be. And so I think that is good, and that portends well. And but yeah, I think it's, you know, I've been waiting to kind of write. I've had this in my head for a while that, you know, there's, you and I talked about me working on a story about what we do with the postseason and the selection committee and what the field of 64 looks like in a world where the schedule is really different. And I've gotten some opinions from that based on theoreticals from coaches, but you know, until we actually kind of know what these schedules look like, we're just guessing. So I've been kind of waiting to see that just so I can start to theorize about what we do from a postseason perspective. And hopefully Coach Losnagel's right. And here in a couple of weeks, we start to have some dominoes falling, some big, you know, major conference dominoes falling to kind of give us an idea of what we're going to be looking at, because then you can start to piece other things together in terms of, you know, seeing what other teams are going to be doing based on what schedules are out and what we know about the teams that have released their schedules early.
I do think it's notable, just to put a bow on this, that two major college baseball coaches have come on this podcast in the last month to 6 weeks. I don't remember exactly when Brian O'Connor was on the podcast and mentioned four game weekends in conference play. You know, that's nobody's saying it's happening yet. And, you know, it's not totally out there. You know, obviously nothing has been decided in the ACC or the Big 12 or anywhere else. But that didn't escape my attention. And I think it is notable that those two coaches both brought that up independently.
I think you're probably like me in that I've heard that theorized kind of off the record and privately in conversations too. It seems like a pretty popular approach, and it stands to, I mean, that seems reasonable. Fewer weekends, more games. I mean, at least on its face.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe it's same number of weekends or whatever, right. But like then less importance of non-conference. Yeah. I mean, same number of conference weekends, although, you know, Schlossnagel obviously threw out the idea of, you know, maybe instead of 10, it's 12 or, you know, whatever. But I do think that, you know, that's notable, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the direction that many conferences went, which in some ways is a throwback. That's how things used to be. Things in the Big Ten were like that not that long ago.
Yeah, and you just hope, like, this is a conversation for, you know, well down the road and for another time. But, you know, there's been what's it, Brian Hainlein? Is that the guy, the NCAA's medical officer?
That sounds right.
Who talked about, you know, the fact that we might see effects of this going as far as like 2023 or what have you. And I do hope, and I think people are motivated to do so, but just from a college baseball standpoint, like, you know, you just hope that this is a one or maybe a 2 year thing for a lot of these conferences, and that we get back to something approaching what we had before in a few years down the road. Because I say that because I think we had gotten to a good place in college baseball where more of the bigger programs were looking to get into some of these big time events. Fewer programs in college baseball, which wasn't always the case, fewer programs in college baseball were really looking to hide their team in non-conference and to just kind of hang out at home. And every once in a while a team will do it, and that's fine. But, like, you know, I think most teams are in the habit of trying to play the best games they can in non-conference. And I thought we had arrived at a good place pre-pandemic as far as that goes. And so I hope we see a return to that. And I think we will. It's just probably a matter of just being patient about it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would say to that is there's a group of coaches that would say that they hope that within a couple of years, they're playing under the new model calendar. And then what does that mean for non-conference play? And I mean, that's like three steps down the line, and I don't have an answer to that. So I don't know, but, you know, this year, hopefully we're still able to get some of these non-conference matchups. Obviously that makes an NCAA tournament, you know, putting a field together much easier, much better. Got a lot more data that way. We'll see that. That is maybe the next story to just be cognizant of that it's coming, is that it's about time to start looking at schedules for 2021. So what are those going to look like? All right, Joe, our latest top 25 was, again, looking ahead at the 2021 season, trying to take a stab at projecting who would lead the nation. This time in stolen bases, we tackled home runs and strikeouts over the last 2 weeks. This time it was stolen bases, giving some love to the speedsters out there. And it's an interesting group. If you look at the strikeout chart, if you look especially at the home run leaderboard from a year ago, those guys are now basically all in pro baseball. If you look at the strikeout leaderboard, a lot of those guys are now in pro baseball. The stolen base chart was a little more mixed, and perhaps not surprisingly, a little less famous than the other two. So I don't know. It's an interesting group overall. You have some really big names like Levi Usher from Louisville, or even a Luke Brown or a Mike Antico. But you also have some guys that, you know, even the more dedicated college baseball observer out there might not be as familiar with some of those guys. So it was an intriguing list to try and piece together.
No, yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about this, and one of the things that makes this list hard, is that you can pile on the speedsters here, and you can, that's kind of what you have to start with. So you look at who the guys who are known to be fast, and that's why you have a guy like Enrique Bradfield, a freshman, on this list. But you also just have to kind of look at what programs have a history of this, of running, because it's, you know, a pitcher is going to strike out as many hitters as his talent and the opposition will allow. A hitter will do the same with home runs. There are, I'm sure, plenty of fast guys in college baseball that have like a perpetual green light, but maybe not all that many. You kind of have to run when the situation allows you to run. Also, you can't steal second base if you have a guy clogging up the bases in front of you. So it is a lot more situational and also a lot more based on what programs like to run. There are some programs that are just don't really like to run for one reason or another. There are also some that are just known for it. So, you know, we have two Louisville players in the top five. Part of that is because Luke Brown and Levi Usher are really fast players. It's also because Louisville likes to run. They've had a number of big stolen base totals through the years. And, you know, I know for a fact from having sat in on an ABCA talk with them that, you know, the Louisville offense, which is led by Vrabel and Snyder, they want to steal 100 bases a year. And so you kind of know that's going to be their baseline there. So Louisville's in there. And Fordham is another one. Alvin Melendez is in the top five for kind of that same reason. Fordham likes to run. You know, Rob DeToma, who was an assistant there, is now at Fairleigh Dickinson. So maybe the approach changes a little bit, but I doubt it. I think they're probably still a lock to run a lot. So you have to look at that. And so you take some of that. You take some of the guys who are just known to be really fast. You know, I talked about Bradfield or Braden Ward at Washington is another example there. You can take a flyer for the same reason on Max Marshak at Texas Tech, just a known burner. So one of the reasons why it's fun to put this list together is because you're pulling from a lot of different buckets. With the strikeout guys, you're mostly pulling from guys with big-time stuff who are going to start games. And the home run hitters, you're pulling from big, strong guys who are going to be starters. With the stolen base guys, it's a few different buckets. You've got teams that like to run a lot, players who are really fast, you know, players with a history of stealing a lot of bases, and you're kind of mixing and matching that list together, which makes it, to your point, more eclectic than the previous two lists, I would say.
Yeah, it's been interesting the last couple of weeks to kind of take this route with the top 25s. I don't know if we've got a fourth one in us, but you know, to look ahead to the 2021 season through this kind of lens, you know, it has been prior to this week a lot about like examining who might be the stars of college baseball. This was a little more specific, but you know, there are still a lot of stars here and a lot of really important players to the teams. It, to your point, you know, depends a lot on offensive philosophy though, and there are some teams out there that just really like to run. That's just a big part of what they do in baseball is that they want to get on base and they want to create havoc out there. And you know, you see a Fordham or a Louisville or a Texas Tech, and like that's just a big part of what they do. They're always going to have players like that, and it's exciting to see them come through and you know take to those philosophies and make them their own and run with it. In this case, literally.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what like the most esoteric stat we could do this on. Like I'm scrolling through the NCAA stats here, and I don't know what it would be. Like maybe sacrifice bunts. You know, is like pretty.
We're not doing that.
Pretty esoteric stat we could do. There's some pretty specific stuff in here that we obviously will not be doing. Outfield assists. If we really wanted to get like wonky with this, obviously we will not be doing that. I joke. However, like if we really wanted to get in the weeds with some of this stuff, it is definitely out there to be done.
Absolutely. And like I think that this is a little more fun that like we could have done ERA for pitchers, but you know, really that just kind of becomes like, okay, who do we think the 25 best pitchers in the country are going to be? You know, at least with strikeouts, you got to like look at it like, okay, like who gets strikeouts? Who's going to get a bunch of innings? Like there's a little more to it than just like, here's who we think the 25 best pitchers are for the 2021 season. Although, I mean, I guess we could just do that as well.
Right. Yeah. Interesting list nonetheless. But yes, I think you're right. I think that what made these last three list we put together interesting. It's just that you kind of have to think through, you have to think a couple levels deeper than just looking at who are the most talented guys, you know, in a given aspect of the game. And so I even on this list with the stolen bases, I was a little bit gun shy for a player who's, I don't know how quite to put this, but it was too good. Like Colton Cowher's on this list from Sam Houston State. And, you know, he's the type of guy, he's going to do enough offensively for them that sometimes if you have a guy who's really involved in the offense, whether he's hitting a bunch of home runs or he's just, you know, shows gap power and he's on base all the time, like sometimes those players don't run as much just because I think to some degree it's the coaching staff trying to keep them fresh, trying to keep them healthy, all of that. On the other hand, he's going to be such a big part of what Sam Houston State is trying to do offensively. It's entirely possible he goes crazy and just steals a bunch of bases because he's trying to make things happen. So he's a little bit of a different situation there. But for the most part, I almost was like a little bit hesitant to put, you know, players who were too good on this list, because it's often not that the big name players who are for whatever reason high on the stolen base list. And it's a specific skill. I get it. But I also think there's another aspect to, you know, if there's something other than steal bases you can do, like oftentimes I think that's where those players tend to shine. So I don't know quite what goes on there, but it was definitely a thought process I had as I tried to put names in the list.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is just like if you're going to be the three-hole hitter, you're probably not going to be allowed to run right in front of the four-hole hitter.
Right.
Whereas if you're the leadoff hitter, you just have the green light. You know, it might be something as simple as that. And, you know, Colton Cowher might just have a green light. They might, you know, no matter where he's hitting. But, you know, everyone, you know, there's a green light. There's a Ricky Henderson green light. And then there's a green light with like, okay, but like, this is our philosophy on you running. Like, you run when you feel like it, but like, also understand these other three things about the offense that like you're a part of and that this is a part of. You know, whereas if you have Ricky Henderson, you say run and that happens. That's not as common. So yeah, I do think there's something to that. It's interesting that Levi Usher stole as many bases as he did last year. Now some of that is just Louisville's offensive philosophy. I'll be interested to see what he does this year. If that gets reined in at all, the construction of the Louisville offense is going to be very interesting. Just when you have Luke Brown, Levi Usher, and Alex Benellis right there at the top of the order, they can do a lot of damage. So some of it is going to come down to how they want to do that damage. So definitely something to watch if you're watching a Louisville Cardinal baseball game next year, or if you're just thinking about their lineup.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. That's I'm kind of knee deep in Louisville stuff right now because later this week. And I guess this is a good segue to closing the podcast. Later this week, I'll have by the time you listen to this, it'll probably be out. My fall questions piece on Louisville and that position player group is really, really good. I mean, that might be the best position player group in college baseball, frankly. And I didn't think I'd arrive at that place, but then you look at it and you look at the talent that they have there, the proven ability that a lot of them have. They've got some depth. I think it's a really interesting group of players. And for the most part, they're all good athletes. I think, you know, Usher and Brown and to a certain degree Lucas Dunn are going to have the bulk of the stolen bases there. But I think anybody can run that lineup for the most part. It's a pretty athletic group.
Yeah, I'm very bullish on it. That's a big part of why Louisville's ranked where they are, is because I really like that Louisville position player group. Very excited to see how that shakes out. So, yes, check out the Louisville fall questions piece. We've got plenty of those over on the website, both online now that you can check out and that will be going up throughout this week. We'll have Michigan on tap and probably a couple others later in the week as well. You can follow Joe and me on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. And if you haven't subscribed yet to the Baseball America podcast, you can do so in your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, really wherever you're getting your podcasts, you can find us. And if you are so inclined to leave a 5-star rating or a review, we greatly appreciate those as well. We will be back here on next week's edition of the Baseball America College podcast. next week. We'll have another great guest from around college baseball. We've had a lot of great guests this fall. We really appreciate everyone taking the time to join us this week. That was TCU coach Jim Schlossnagel. So thanks again to him for joining us today. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Rapsodo and Keeps. Remember, you can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll see you guys next week on the Baseball America College Podcast.